Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions, with support from the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky and the Appalachian Impact Fund, working together to promote community collaboration, economic development, and education by increasing charitable giving and philanthropic investments across communities in southeastern Kentucky. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. It's impossible to stay on top of all of the myriad ways coronavirus is affecting us. One important way, though, starts with a provision in a contract that excuses, in whole or in part, performance by one or both parties in the face of a force majeure. It can be found in contracts between many businesses and organizations and their suppliers and vendors. We have on the line Lexington attorney Steve Amato with the firm McBrayer. Force majeure law is in his area of expertise, and we thank you for joining us, Steve.
Well, thanks for having me, Tom.
Let's begin with a definition. How is force majeure defined under Kentucky law?
Tom, courts have interpreted this force majeure provision or contract provision as an event that's commonly considered to be caused by overpowering, superior, or irresistible forces, such as an act of God, which is beyond the reasonable control of parties and cannot be avoided by the exercise of due care. So in this context, that would be either the illness itself, which prevents people from meeting their obligations, or probably more commonly in this instance, the orders of the government to restrict our activities, which prevent us from performing obligations that we're required to do either personally or as part of our business.
So the coronavirus itself is a force majeure event?
It could be. That would have to be ultimately determined by a court as to whether or not it is such a superior force that would interfere with your ability to perform. We've looked at this, and I do believe that the illness itself will be a sufficient event under certain contracts and certain circumstances. Probably more commonly, however, the event that gives rise to the ability to avoid an obligation will be the government restrictions that flow from the illness. But that's to be determined in a case-by-case situation as the disputes arise in the coming weeks and months when parties are unable to perform as they typically do.
So, Steve, what are you hearing in the legal world? Are force majeure clauses being activated, being discussed?
What I've heard from clients, and I think it's consistent across the board, is that parties are examining their contracts. Force majeure provisions, in certain instances, are highly negotiated, prominent features when contracts are made. But to be honest, I think more often than not, force majeure provisions are often part of the boilerplate that are in contracts that parties don't really take a look at because these events obviously don't happen very often in the normal context. And so parties are taking a look at their leases, residential leases, their commercial leases, their supply contracts, and trying to determine whether they have a force majeure provision at all. If so, how it's defined, and then trying to apply the current circumstances to that provision and analyzing whether or not they're going to be able to force performance by their co-party or whether their own performance can be excused.
Is this force majeure language fairly common in contracts?
Yes, it's certainly common in supply chain contracts. It is common in commercial leases. It's certainly common in transportation contracts, for example. Sometimes they're very specifically negotiated, and other times they're just boilerplate left over from years of repetition.
Okay, so now that we understand force majeure, can you give us a sense of the range of industries in your portfolio that might be impacted by this crisis?
Sure. I represent a lot of retail establishments involved in the sale of alcohol in the hospitality industry, for example. So I have many clients who have commercial leases for their space, and a lot of these businesses are shut down now, and even before they were shut down, people had stopped coming, and they have an inability to pay rent as a result of that. I represent certain suppliers of various different products who have received orders to supply products in the coming weeks and months, and now their businesses are either shut down by virtue of government orders or because their employees are at home and there's no one there to pack and produce and fulfill these orders. And so these suppliers are going to be unable to fulfill their orders in the coming weeks and months. And so that's something that a lot of people are looking at. And on the same side, you have a lot of businesses that have placed orders for goods and services, anticipating the continuing nature of commerce for the weeks and months ahead, who no longer have any need for those products and no longer have any need for those services, and they want out of their obligation to pay for those goods and services. And so everybody's looking at what it is that they're expected to be doing the next 2 or 3 months, 6, 8 weeks, and figuring out whether they want to, whether they can, and what they can do about it.
So what we have here is a major, I would say even profound, event that came at us right out of the blue. I mean, this pretty much caught people off guard. It must be setting off quite a domino tumble throughout the supply chains, throughout business and industry.
Yes, sir. I think that every business that's involved in the production of goods and the delivery of services is looking at what it is they expected to be doing the next 6 to 8 weeks, 2 or 3 months, and trying to figure out, can they do it? Do they want to do it? Can they afford to do it? And if they don't, what are going to be the consequences?
So I take it your role, Steve, is to help businesses and individuals who also are involved in contracts assess the impact of all this, to kind of figure out where they are with it.
We're trying to help businesses mitigate the impact of this. And so if we have a client that has a contract that required them to produce and deliver certain goods and services over the next period of time, we're helping look at their contracts and find out whether or not they have a contract provision that will excuse their performance. Similarly, if we have a business that has ordered a bunch of product and no longer needs or wants it, how can they get out of the obligation to receive and pay for those goods and services? But overarching all of this, it's not entirely a situation where it's all or nothing. Hopefully, presumably, this is a temporary condition, and businesses and individuals alike are free to amend their agreements and their understandings and delay performance, for example, reduce the scope of the expected performance. There's a lot of things in between complete compliance and total disaster. And I think that we're encouraging our clients, and I know that it's this way across the board, we're encouraging our clients and our clients' co-parties to exercise some reason and to take a step back, recognize that this is likely, at least in many instances, a temporary condition with temporary hindrances, and try to map out a way to go forward. And we expect that the courts will also take a similar approach. We've already seen where the government has stepped in and imposed certain relief measures to help people get through the short term. So that's part of our advice to clients as well.
So it would be in a businessman's, businesswoman's favor to be proactive now and to communicate and so forth?
Yes, sir. I've given that advice a half a dozen times in the past week to clients that are worried about making lease payments and fulfilling orders, to reach out and communicate with the co-party, acknowledge the obvious elephant in the room that not going to be able to meet this obligation. You certainly know why. And here's what I intend to do about it. And whether that is to make a partial payment or make a partial delivery, or to give a credit, or to say, I'll do it, but it's going to be a week from now, to offer accommodations, to be candid about it. And similarly, for people who are owed money or owed services, our advice has been, recognize the position of your co-party, recognize that you've been in business with these people for a period of time, and you're going to want to continue to have the goods and services that you've received from them over the past years. and see if you can find a way to afford some sort of an accommodation that will enable you to pick up the relationship where this virus interrupted things.
What if you're standing there holding a contract that does not have a force majeure clause? Are there still ways to excuse contract performance for unforeseeable events like this one?
There are several concepts embedded in our law and the law of most states that would give parties opportunities to avoid contractual obligations, economic obligations. Some of those concepts, for example, are called frustration of purpose. When you have an arrangement with another party and the entire reason for that arrangement has disappeared because of circumstances, there are similar concepts called impracticability, which is something short of impossibility, but just makes performance extremely difficult, more costly. The doctrine of impracticability is actually built into Kentucky statutes in the UCC Sales Act. And then there is the concept of impossibility, which is when circumstances are such that it is literally impossible to perform. You're literally impossible to produce and deliver these goods, impossible to pay the amounts that are owed. Not sure that the current circumstances are going to give rise to a whole lot of impossibility claims, but certainly impracticability, which opens up the door for parties to get together, recognize those temporary burdens, and come up with a solution.
And what if there is no contract between the parties?
Well, the frustration of purpose, impracticability, and possibility would also apply to oral contracts.
Uh-huh. Okay, well, we really appreciate you taking time to spell this out for us. Lexington attorney Steve Amato with the Lexington firm McBrayer, where he works with clients faced with contracts suddenly disrupted by the coronavirus crisis. Thank you so much, Steve.
Thank you, Tom. Good to speak with you.
Just when you were getting used to this place, you were getting used to these bones, you were getting used to the changes. Well, the change won't leave you alone. You finally caught up with the pace. The tough just might have got cold. You thought you could trust all the faces. Well, they're only on one side of the coin. All these changes, different stages, turning page after page after page, get stranger day by day.
WEKU is now providing a daily 10-minute coronavirus update. Hosted by Kelly McEvers, NPR's Coronavirus Daily podcast is available at weku.org. Look for the blue coronavirus link and click the Listen Now tab to hear the latest stories. The program is available wherever you listen to podcasts and at weku.org. Our version of social distancing here at Eastern Standard is to switch from studio to phone interviews. Coming up after the break, four conversations that took place here in the studio before we made the switch to phones only. They're about news deserts in Kentucky, reducing the carbon footprint of cement, getting cardiac patients back on their feet, and
the easiest way for folks to learn about arts and culture events is from other people who are interested in arts and culture, and it becomes this very insular type of community while the interest is much, much larger.
A website that lets us know what's happening off the beaten path in the Lexington area arts world. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Support for WEKU and Eastern Standard comes from Hicks and Funson. Kentucky lawyers Greg Funson, Kenny Heumann, Kayla Combs, and Shannon Church provide legal representation for auto accidents, medical malpractice, elder care, and immigration law. More information at 859-777-7000. Would you like to listen again to this Eastern Standard or past episodes? Find them online at weku.org or on the WEKU mobile app. Do you have a news tip, a comment, or a question for Eastern Standard? Leave a message at 859-522-WEKU. It might be featured on a future show. Now, back to Eastern Standard with Tom Martin.
Like just about every industry in the United States, the media business is being subjected to widespread consolidation and the relentless cost-cutting that follows that. The result has been the weakening or even the collapse of many local newsrooms. What happens when an area loses its local newspaper? Dee Davis, publisher of the Daily Yonder and president of the Center for Rural Strategies, recently wrote an op-ed about this, headlined, "In a Desert, Any Oasis Will Do." He's joining us from WMMT at Apple Shop in Whitesburg, and we thank you so much, Dee.
Great to be here, Tom.
You describe a news desert in eastern Kentucky and, for that matter, other rural areas around the country. What do you mean by this?
Well, the news desert is a kind of designation that's come down on a lot of small places that are losing their newspapers, losing their coverage, and I think it's analogous to food deserts where grocery stores are disappearing. But the idea being that these are places that are not served by the press in the same way that they had been before. So in places like East Kentucky, we begin to lose the services of daily regional newspapers. We begin to lose local coverage, and then we begin to lose distribution. You know, the papers don't show up on your doorstep.
In a lot of communities, the local paper has been around for a long, long time. It would be easy to take it for granted. And as they say, you don't miss something until it's gone. Are people missing their local paper?
I think it's generational. I think that those of us who grew up with the Courier Journal on our kitchen table or the Lexington Herald, it's pretty important for us. That's how our world was shaped. It's how we got to UK ball scores or the Reds, and it's also how we found out about the perfidy of our politicians. Now we've got a situation where it's much more dispersed how we get our information, and we kind of sort through a variety of different devices or different people who we are trusted brokers who we get our news from. So it's quite different. I think it's hard to find somebody 35 or younger who has cable television or who gets a newspaper. That's pretty much a ship that sailed. So I think for those of us of a certain vintage that grew up with it, we miss it, but it's not the normal.
We are going through a time of transition right now. We're all experiencing it in our own way, depending on our generation and so forth. But if you could, let's go back about 15 years or so when newspapers had bureaus in eastern Kentucky. What began happening to start shuttering or closing those bureaus?
Well, they're really a consolidation of the news industry was the leading edge that all of a sudden, as more and more corporations took over, more and more what were family or regional papers, they were able to bring a higher rate of return on investment, maybe 24%, whereas local papers would be closer to half that. So there was a real profit incentive to the consolidation in the industry. And then that meant more and more consolidation often means more and more layoffs, more and more national news services. And so that started a process, but then the technology took over because in recent years, as a delivery system, for a long time, it was how expensive is newsprint, how hard is it to get the paper to the paper carrier, how hard is it for that person to get it to the doorstep. And now that it's pretty much seamlessly electronically delivered, that changed everything.
In that 15-year or so time period since about 2004, 2005, about 1,800 newspapers have closed, and that's been leaving towns and cities and sometimes whole counties with no meaningful source of local reporting. What are the implications for democracy itself of this kind of hollowing out of newspapers and other vital reporting outlets at the city, state, and the regional levels?
Well, it changes the nature of the news. You know, people remember back when there was only three networks and everybody watched the nightly news and they got pretty much the same take on what was going on in the world. Well, now that's completely gone and everybody gravitates to their own set of news to confirm their own biases and to tickle their own itches. You know, right now we have a situation where you don't have to see any news you don't want to see. You don't have to pay attention to any opinion that's not yours to start with. And so more and more we've gotten a personally directed news feed. And with that, there's some advantages, but there's also some cost. And among those costs are the kind of common purpose media that a lot of us grew up with.
Yeah, a lot of us grew up with media that had a local reporter going to city council or to the county commission or to any government public hearing where the information could be reported. That's kind of gone in a lot of places now. What are the consequences of that?
Well, what we've seen is different kinds of news outlets beginning to take over and play a larger role. And in rural areas, what we've seen is a real growth in small church radio stations and evangelical newsletters taking a big slice of the news distribution role that papers and broadcasters used to play. So you've gotten a different kind of news feed, one that is often tied to nationalized political leanings and oftentimes tied up into fundraising campaigns.
Well, of course, this has all led to political polarization. We're all experiencing that these days. But I wonder if you could talk to us a minute about how it might have contributed to deepening the divisions between people living in rural versus urban areas.
Yeah, one of the things that really happened was that as the newspapers pulled back into their urban and suburban hubs, it's the same time the broadcasters did too. The local TV stations went to the more urban areas where people were more well-heeled. You know, the suburbs are certainly wealthier than a lot of rural places like here in Kentucky. And then you began to see deficiencies of radio broadcasts mean that there was more satellite feeds replacing local reporters and local programming. So all that tended to focus on metropolitan areas, leaving gaps throughout rural America. And in those gaps, people took advantage and began to figure out how they could get in and create audiences and create relationships with audiences in the same way that papers and radio stations had done in the past. And so what we've got now is a very urbanized news delivery service system, and we've got a clutch of different strategies that are going on in rural areas.
Kentucky Wired is one of those, I guess. That's the project to deliver broadband internet to rural parts of Kentucky. It's kind of installed. Its future is a bit uncertain at this point. in today's very online world, as you've described, has access to solid, fast internet service become vital to rural communities? And if it were available, could it help revitalize local journalism, do you think?
Yeah, there was a lot of hope for Kentucky Wired when the plan was to have, you know, fiber to each of the towns by 2016. You know, there's the dream and the dream deferred. Right now, there are a lot of competing systems that are working in rural areas. And what people have a hard time understanding is that people in rural areas tend to pay more for lousier service. And how well you're connected has a lot to do with the quality of life, right? If you want your kids to compete in school, then it really depends on how well they're connected and they're going to get their homework. If you want to enjoy modern medicine and what it can do in a community, you need to have the connectivity. And the same way, if you want to bring your goods and services to market, you need to be connected. And so in a lot of rural areas, the connections is not what has been promised, and it's not what we need.
Well, Dee, if you could wave a magic wand and fix this situation, this news desert situation in rural areas, what would you like to see happen?
Well, first of all, if I had that magic wand, that might not be my top priority, but I think that what we have to do is to create systems that let local people tell their story, and we have to use the technology in a way that connects us and helps us solve problems together. There's a lot of communitarian things that we can do. We can deal with local problems. We can warn people when the winds are up or the water's high. And there are ways that we can bring the magic of learning into a lot of our communities. What we have to do is get just some basic infrastructure support in terms of getting those services, whether that's by government fiat or by a more responsive telecommunications industry. But once we've got that, then I think there's going to be more opportunity for local strategies that work. And then I think that I don't fault the local papers, the regional papers. I mean, in Eastern Kentucky, the Lexington Herald has great reporters, Estep and Wright, who are working as diligently to get news out. I mean, the recent Black Jewel news, the looking at defaults and bonds, these are important stories for the future of Eastern Kentucky. So the problem is not that the stories aren't being written. The problem is they're not getting out to enough people who can use that information to make a plan or to make a good vote.
It's going to be interesting to see how all of this evolves. You're right about Bill Estep and Will Wright. They are out there doing yeoman's work to cover the issues of Eastern Kentucky. Perhaps it's the time to evolve the platform. I don't know what that looks like, but I guess that's where we are.
Yeah, we're evolving, sometimes not as fast as we wish.
True. Dee Davis, publisher of the Daily Yonder. He's president of the Center for Rural Strategies, and he joins us from WMMT at Apple Shop in Whitesburg. Thank you so much.
Sure thing, Tom.
With the impact of the coronavirus crisis taken into account, community papers could end the year with losses of 20 to 25% in local advertising. That's according to Corey Elliott. He heads research at the local advertising analysis company, Burrell Associates. And Elliott notes quite an irony in all this. He says, quote, "We're seeing probably the greatest demand for local news since before the transformation to a digital ecosystem happened." It's not very often that we talk about concrete and cement here on Eastern Standard, and that may be because until lately, it seemed right up there with watching grass grow or paint dry. But then we found out about something going on at the University of Kentucky's Center for Applied Energy Research and had to know more about this. The center has received a 2-year, $1.3 million grant to develop extremely durable Baylite-based cement, an alternative to ordinary Portland cement that's low energy consuming and low carbon dioxide releasing. Bob Jewell, principal investigator for the project and research program director at the center, is here to tell us about it. Thanks for coming in, Bob.
Yeah, thank you very much, Tom.
And first, if you would help us with some of the terminology, for example, what is Baylite-based cement and how does it differ from ordinary Portland cement?
Baylite is a common phase in Portland cements. In fact, the folks at the Department of Energy, so ARPA is the Advanced Research Projects Agency for Energy, believes Baylite could be a contributing factor to durable cements. With the stresses of increasing cement production to meet industry demands, there's been faster production at elevated temperatures, so sort of a reduction in the amount of Baylite present in our cements. So we're looking at developing high-volume Baylite cements. So it is a common strength-forming binder that is in the cement, but sort of helps create the glue that holds all the aggregate together in the concrete. But it is a slow reacting phase. It takes time, too much time for people to involve at high volume. So the project is looking at developing a cement that has a large volume of this Baylite, this dicalcium silicate, and then kicking it off fast, making it react quickly.
For everybody who's listening who doesn't really understand the mechanics of it, what kind of difference will this make in the built environment out there?
Yeah, it's a good question. So why would we take the time to develop a high Baylite cement? Well, Portland cement is it's a fantastic material. It's been around a long time. But as the world does, things change and there's certain new demands that we need to meet and durability. So let's build something, but why focus on 20 years from now? Why even focus on 50? Why not try to make something that could last a 200-year lifespan? So now you're reducing replacement costs, the need for extra new materials to rebuild or repair structures. And then you're cutting down on time on construction workers, their vehicles out there. All these things are producing CO2 in some part of that supply chain. So, and that's the focus. So this material, yes, it has that Baylite component, but the idea is to make it more durable, more impermeable, so things from nature can't get in and break it down and destroy it. A lot of things, concrete and steel rebar is in many of our structures. Concrete in many ways protects that rebar, but once it breaks down, chlorides from salt or from the environment can get in, that rebar breaks down and expands, cracks concrete. So there's a number of durability issues that we hope to resolve by developing this new cement.
Do you think people would be surprised to find out how concrete contributes to greenhouse gases, and how does it do that?
Concrete is a large contributor. In fact, it's if you look it up, it's probably the third largest source of CO2 emissions worldwide. In fact, for every ton of CO2 produced, there's about one ton of CO2 emitted into the atmosphere. In the U.S., last year, we produced roughly 90 million tons of cement. Worldwide, it was numbered somewhere around 4.1 billion tons. So if you put that on a per ton equivalent to CO2 emissions, it's large, very large. So, of course, number one would be a fossil fuel, so electricity and heat production using fossil fuels. Then the deforestation, agricultural use, and then cement construction.
So what you're working on is one way that is available to us to reduce carbon dioxide in the built environment, right?
It is. And so what also is unique with this, we said the efforts in our research lab at the Center for Applied Energy Research is you can develop these cements from industrial byproducts. So what is otherwise known as a waste, it may be landfilled or may be utilized for other purposes, but here's an opportunity to go in and offset some materials that would otherwise be mined new. So we can replace those with these waste products. In many cases, especially from the materials from our coal combustion industry, the CO2 has already been emitted in that process. And so there would be a carbon savings in the manufacturer's cement because now you're using less limestone, so which is one of your primary reasons you're having CO2 emissions in cement manufacture. From burning limestone. So you're offsetting things on the front end. in doing so, you can also reduce your temperature in which that cement is manufactured. So say from a 1450 degrees Celsius down to, say, 1250 degrees. So there's an energy savings in that alone in burning your kilns at lower temperatures.
Bob Jewell, Research Program Manager at the University of Kentucky's Center for Applied Energy Research. Thank you, Bob.
Yeah, thank you very much, Tom.
Cement makes a putty putty. Cement makes a putty putty. Cement makes a putty putty. A buttity beat concrete. First you get some gravel. Pour it in the vault. To mix a mess of mortar, you add cement and water, and see the Mellaroonie come out.
If you're ranking the 50 states according to annual number of deaths due to heart disease, Kentucky is among the top 10. Heather Whitson sees the results of this on a daily basis. She is an exercise physiologist at the ARH Cardiac Rehab Clinic in Hazard, and she joins us from WMMT in Whitesburg. Greetings, Heather.
Hello.
So, Heather, tell us more about what goes on in a cardiac rehab clinic.
Any time that you faced any kind of heart event, you know, stents, MIs. We even do stable angina, post valve repairs, replacements. You would just enroll in our cardiac rehab program with a doctor's referral. Once you've enrolled in our program, you'd come two to three times a week. We will put you on a heart monitor once you arrive. And then after that, we kindly set you up with the exercise program. We introduce you to a nutritional guide. Then we'll kind of review your medicines, make sure you understand how you take those medicines, and kind of just start you off slow and help progress your exercise.
I mentioned in the introduction that Kentucky figures into the top 10 among states for heart disease. How prevalent is it in eastern Kentucky?
Kentucky is one of the top 10, and I think the further eastern Kentucky to go, the higher the risk are. And I think a lot of people are just unaware of the cardiac events.
Are there behaviors or habits that play into that?
Yes, you higher your risk, and with, you know, the higher your blood pressure, it's good to monitor your blood pressure, know your heart rate, be aware of that. If you smoke, it higher your risk. Also, if you're diabetic, that will higher your risk for heart disease. Also, you know, genetics. In eastern Kentucky, we sometimes, you know, we're more sedentary. We just carry on those habits from generation to generation.
So, Heather, if you could describe for us your typical patient.
Most patients we see in air rehab or post-stent, post-bypass, those patients, I'd say 80% of our patients have a history of being diabetic, have a history of being a tobacco user. But once, you know, they come in our program, that's what we're there for. We're there to help educate them, get them on the right path to, you know, success for the rest of their life.
You shared a chart with me, and it's broken down into less likely for cardiac rehab referral and more likely for cardiac rehab referral. Can you describe that chart for our listeners?
Yes. So one thing after a cardiac event, it's really important that you ask your doctor about getting referred to our cardiac rehab, because a lot of patients get left out. Only 10% of patients who face cardiac events get referred to us. You know, if you have more than just cardiac history, then you're more or less likely not to get referred. Actually, women tend to get less referred to cardiac rehab programs. And it's just important to ask your doctor, say, what do you think about me joining a cardiac rehab program? And most of the time, they'll just send off that referral, and we can get you in right away.
You mentioned earlier that there's this variety of heart procedures depending on the condition, like bypass surgery, heart valves and valve replacements, stents, heart attacks, stable angina. Does the rehab that you provide differ from condition to condition?
No, we pretty much treat all of our patients with just cardio exercises. We do some strength training along, but really, in general, all those diagnosis that you're going to get the most benefit from just doing cardio. We would just monitor their vital signs all exactly the same, and everybody will be on the heart monitor while they're there as well.
What sorts of beneficial outcomes of cardiac rehab have you seen among patients that you've worked with?
People that have come to our cardiac rehab, you know, it lowers your blood pressure. It helps stabilize the heart rate. I've seen people come off some of their medications as they continue the rehab program, but it's very vital to come very regularly. That's the people who I see get the most benefit from the program.
What frustrates you most about heart disease in Eastern Kentucky?
What I see is, you know, people have these heart events and they never take any steps further to change their, you know, their diet habits, adding on exercise, quitting smoking or any kind of tobacco cessation. And I think it's very important for even our children to really take these steps and really educate our children, because we don't want those numbers to continue to rise in Eastern Kentucky.
Heather Whitson is an exercise physiologist at the ARH Cardiac Rehab Clinic in Hazard. She joins us from WMMT in Whitesburg. Thank you, Heather.
Thank you.
Once we're able to get back out and about, and we will, it would be great to know about interesting things happening that may not pop up on mainstream event calendars and such. Art Checkit with our arts and culture partner, Undermain, talks with Dima Strakowski, associate professor in the UK School of Art and Visual Studies.
Welcome, Dima. We are going to talk about a project you've been working on for a couple of years now, Infinite Industries.
Infinite Industries is a platform. It's currently a web-based platform that allows us to discover cultural events around Lexington and some surrounding areas in a more accessible and, frankly, easier ways than anything available to us outside of this platform.
What makes it easier and more accessible? How did you devise it to make it more user-friendly?
Gotcha. So the very first thing that we've got to kind of consider is the fact that we are living in attention economy, i.e. There's variety of different types of apps, services that are vying for our attention, some of them in cultural sphere, some of them are outside. And what we're trying to do is to figure out the sort of the quickest way for people to get a snapshot of what's going on, and then perhaps drill into things that they are themselves interested in. For example, right, the easiest thing to throw out there, of course, is Facebook. So we've been very much trained by a very large multinational corporation called Facebook to put our events out there. But what Facebook is trying to do is, of course, for us to give it as much attention and time as possible. So along with information, there are various different design cues that basically get us to engage with the content for longer time. Now, what we're trying to do is also use language of design, right? So, for example, we have a card interface, a very easy-to-see, easy-to-scan card interface on the website that also scales very nicely when we're looking at it on mobile platforms, so on your cell phone. And we're trying to actually minimize the amount of time that people will engage with a platform, frankly. So someone scans, someone figures out what they want to kind of see, give a little bit more attention to. They get the information, they get directions, and then they go to the event or not.
So if I go to the website, what might that look like to me? You say a card interface. Maybe you mm-hmm. could describe that a little bit more for our listeners.
Essentially, this presents a number of events as image with a little bit of text that includes dates and sometimes a sentence, sometimes less than a sentence description about the event.
So if I go to the website and I'm looking for a particular event, can I find that easily? Is there a search function that I can use on the site? Or is it easy to just scan what's out there to find what I'm looking for?
Currently, we're trying to go for a very minimal type of interface. So no, there's no search function. It's pretty easy to scan, though, you know, to be quite honest, we're starting to get a pretty large number of events. So one of the things that I've been asking potential users is, how do you search for a specific event? One of the things that, you know, is important to kind of know here is that although our ambitions are regional, maybe even national, we're very much dedicated to the local cultural scene and also trying to learn from our user base as much as possible. Currently, there are no find search type of functionalities, but perhaps in the future, we will respond to a need and start using that.
What kind of events might I find on Infinite Industries? Is it all events in Lexington, or is it a selected range of events or particular kinds of events?
Sure. It's a very specific range of cultural events. So we're trying to concentrate on music, theater, visual arts. What we're trying to also do is really promote the events that would otherwise go kind of under the radar. I can give you an example. Parasite won Best Picture, and we're all super happy because it's an amazing film. Everyone was cheering for it.
So now, that's the South Korean movie that won the Best Picture at the Academy Awards.
Yes, yes. But on one of the internal listservs for University of Kentucky, where I teach, and discovered the fact that the subtitle translator for Parasite was actually speaking on campus. So I contacted the person in charge of the event, asked her to put the event on Infinite Industries so we can promote it, and was able to promote it. And I think we actually got pretty good site traffic, so hopefully really good attendance for the event. Otherwise, it would have stayed kind of bound to a smaller group of folks who are very much on campus, who are very much interested in film and perhaps are experts in film or perhaps Korean literature, but it wouldn't have gotten as much play in the wider public sphere in Lexington.
You're faculty at the School of Art and Visual Studies at the University of Kentucky in digital media, correct?
Correct, yes.
How did you get interested in coming up with a essentially cultural and events platform for Lexington?
There's a couple of different paths. One of the paths is through running several gallery spaces, one internal at School of Art and Visual Studies, and then also was working with Drury Parish on Land of Tomorrow, which was a rather large gallery space both here in Lexington and in Louisville. So kind of seeing what type of event promotion and how would a gallery in central Kentucky actually promote its events to the local populace, right, and where some of the pain points are. And then I also have both design and coding backgrounds. So I've worked on several startup projects, and I have also, like, I basically started coding for the web in 1995 when web happened.
So you've had a lot of experience in sort of the back end of developing platforms.
Yes, yes. So basically at some point, faced with these kind of systematic pain points, meaning that, you know, every single time that we're trying to promote event, we're faced with the same issues, the same perhaps lack of audience, not lack of interested audience, but really lack of audience who can easily discover the events, right? Because I'm constantly amazed by the size for the audience for cultural events here in Lexington and in Kentucky in general, right? But it's also the easiest way for folks to learn about arts and culture events is from other people who are interested in arts and culture, and it becomes this very insular type of community while the interest is much, much larger.
So there's a democratization aspect to this project for you too. What's next for Infinite Industries?
So yes, very much democratization is very much a part of the mission. So we have a couple of things that are on the horizons. One is, and horizon is really plural here. So one is we're working with WRFL to create a backend of for events, kind of promotions for their site. That's part of what we're trying to do with Infinite Industries, essentially create this big database of events, of arts and culture events in the sky that other cultural institutions can tap into. The other thing that's on the horizons is perhaps starting to work on an app. This is something that we've promised to both ourselves and many of our users over, you know, significant amount of time, and trying to deliver on that.
Well, listen, we really appreciate you coming on the Radio segment on WKU's Eastern Standard. And we'll look forward to hearing more about Infinite Industries as the project moves forward. Thanks again, Dima.
Thank you.
That's Art Sheckett from Undermain, online at under-main.com, with Infinite Industries' Dima Strakovsky. Next week on Eastern Standard, our series on mental health looks at the ill effects of having so many digital devices in our lives.
We are made for community. We're social animals. We need intimacy. So when technology takes away from that essential aspect of who we are as humans, then I think that causes a big concern and very detrimental effects.
Father Steve Roberts is our guest, interviewed by EKU psychologist Melinda Moore. People played an important role, maybe more important than many today realize, in telling the stories of Appalachian communities a century ago. Samantha Niekamp discovered it in research for her book, Literacy in the Mountains, Community, Newspapers, and Writing in Appalachia.
Initially, I was sort of looking for those circulation rates, that kind of information. But what I found in the papers themselves were community members doing most of the writing. So in these small Appalachian communities like Spout Springs, where there were perhaps 300 or 400 people living in the town, more than 100 of those were writing for the paper.
And as we celebrate the 50th anniversary of our partner Apple Shop, we hear from Rachel Geringer and Rich Kirby on the history of WMMT, the organization's community radio station in Whitesburg.
And I think people have kind of felt that about the station over the years, that they kind of listen into it and sort of feel some kind of community with people that they hear from other parts of the mountains.
That wraps this week's edition. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of the Foundation for Appalachian Kentucky, an accredited community foundation, and their Appalachian Impact Fund. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. You can listen to editions of Eastern Standard online at weku.org or esweku.org, on the WEKU mobile app, or as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. And we do like to hear from you. You can email us at es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.